Before we get underway, Millery Latimer gave me her business card. She's the one that spoke at the back. And on the back of her business card is this, instructions for living a life. Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it.
There you go.
And that's a quote from Mary Oliver.
That's a quote from Mary Oliver.
So,
there you go.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Before I start, I have to quote Robert Hunter again, who also wrote in Eyes of the World, wake up to find out that you are the eyes of the world. Uh-huh. And I was thinking, you know, that's kind of what we're talking about here, is discovering that we have the eyes of the world. What I'm going to say over the next few minutes really depends pretty much entirely on Marianne's account of event as the crucial element. In other words, without what she said, what I have to say I don't think will make much sense. Now, it may well be that it makes no sense anyway, but that will be, you know, that's going to be my fault, not hers, and certainly it won't be your fault. But hers is the foundation of her talk about event and illustrations of event is the foundation of what I'm going to do. So my plan here is first to ground this notion of event in our tradition. And I want to take a couple of examples from both the Jewish scriptures and the Christian additions to it that we call the New Testament. Then what I want to do is apply that tradition to some moments in what is more or less modern history. And finally, what I want to do is to suggest that every single moment of our lives, like what Marianne was saying, is this, the possibility of event is before us. And that I want to get to that notion by talking a little bit about the concept of vocation and what I think that really means, because I think it's related to responding and interacting with event. So the point which I wish to make through all of this, which means actually, if you want to take a shortcut, you can stop listening after I end this sentence. Because the whole point I want to make is that we do not need to wonder if we are living in the presence of the divine. We don't need to, we can stop wondering about that. However you choose, by the way, to understand the term divine. Because we are, and we are living in that presence all the time. What we need to wonder is the extent to which we are paying attention. The extent to which we are being astonished. The extent to which, indeed, we develop the words to talk about it. That's the only thing we really need to wonder about. So, with that, are there any comments, sir? Okay. Okay. First, let's ground this notion of event in our the Judeo-Christian tradition. I want to consider it first from a negative point of view. The parable of the rich man and Lazarus, which is located in the 16th chapter of St. Luke. It is an odd and terrible story in many ways, and some of you will remember it, and I'll remind the rest of us of it. And what makes it particularly odd and particularly terrible is that you can read the story 100 times and you will not find anything the rich man did to deserve ending up in the torments of hell. There's just nothing he actually did. Lazarus is now, after they both die, Lazarus is safely ensconced in heaven in the bosom of Abraham, and it's all quite wonderful. And Abraham is calling over this unbridgeable chasm between them and the rich man who is in hell to deny any possibility that he could receive even a sip of water to relieve his torment. And the reason? Well, we don't want to know, but we find out anyway. Abraham says to him over this chasm, son, remember in your lifetime you received good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things. Abraham reminds him. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish. Really? Is that all you've got? I was rich, and he was poor? Whew. There's nothing the rich man did to deserve condemnation, and the story doesn't claim there was. The issue is what the rich man did not do, not what he did. He did not perceive in Lazarus any call to action. He did not perceive in Lazarus, in other words, the event. He did not see what was really happening and what was really happening. He did not hear in the desperate situation of this sick, destitute man, a world pleading to him to show compassion on a person he had never met and did not know. That's what was happening and what was happening. So in our tradition, we have here this example of the interactivity of event. God, or again, to use another one of my favorite authors, Douglas Adams, life, the universe, and everything, speaks to us of a truth about us in relationship to whatever is. Life was speaking to the rich man, and the rich man heard nothing. He did not perceive that he was being addressed. And because he did not perceive that he was being addressed, because he heard nothing, he ends up with nothing. That's what's going on there. And this interpretation, by the way, is not my own. Albert Schweitzer famously said that that Africa was the Lazarus at the gate of Europe. And so he gave up a considerable career as a doctor, scholar, a musician, to go to Africa and minister there through his medical mission for the rest of his life. He gave up a lot. And of course, from his point of view, he gained a lot more. He heard in the poverty of Africa a call. He perceived in Africa event. And he responded in what ultimately was the only way that he could. But he was a free person. And he too could have heard nothing. But instead, he perceived event and responded. St. Paul uses this same imagery, by the way, of interactivity several times. But the one I chose was when he describes his motivation behind his preaching. He says, "Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am entrusted with a commission." He isn't preaching, in other words, only because he wants to, although I am convinced that Paul really wanted to preach. He loved it. He's preaching, though, because some sort of moment, some sort of interaction between Paul and that larger dimension of life called to him, and in freedom, he responded. In other words, Paul was not thinking about what the world needs. He wasn't thinking about what I need to do to make a difference. He was responding to a moment that spoke to him. Now, in Acts, there are three stories of the road to Damascus. They are not consistent internally, and perhaps we can say that was Paul's event. I don't know. Paul himself never mentions it, but something happened. Some event happened that so completely captured Paul in his own freedom that he responded in this way. The prophet Amos, and many of the prophets, by the way, this would apply to almost any of the prophets. The prophet Amos insisted, in fact, he says, halfway through, or a little bit more than halfway through the book, "I am not a prophet, I am not the son of a prophet, I am a herdsman and a dresser of sycamore trees." Now, by the way, that's not the best living in the world, but it's a job. And yet, Amos perceived a call in the faithlessness of the people, specifically of the northern kingdom at this point. And in obedience to that call, he responded in dramatic fashion, ultimately offering some of the most remembered and profound statements in all of the biblical literature. He's the one who said, "Let justice roll down like a fountain and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." He's the one who said that, for example. The stories of Moses, Isaiah, Jeremiah, they all include events like this. They all include events of call that people initially resisted, and then they're overcome. And they're swept up into a life of response. In fact, I would say this. It's easy to see in this sweep of the whole Jewish Bible something of a trope. Event happens. Whether it is to Moses at the bush, or Amos in the hills and with his herds, or Paul, or whatever, it's easy to see that there is some kind of event. It is initially resisted because we are free people, And finally, the moment comes where the resistance turns into acceptance, where the moment is finally perceived, where what is really going on and what is really going on is finally gotten to. And they go. This is not a case of people wondering how to be helpful. It's not a case of people wondering how to offer something needed. It's a case of people interacting with the call of the moment and realizing in that moment what their whole life is about and what they are going to do from that moment on. So in each of these cases, the relationship between the individual and the God is interactive. None of these characters are mere ciphers, and I want to emphasize that. Nor do they decide on their own to do something irrespective of what's going on about them. Marianne alluded to this. None of them say, I'm going to plan an event. None of them did that. Rather, in freedom, they interact with their environment, their world, their God, and ultimately they perceive a call that they heed. Or, again, in the negative case which I started, the case of the rich man, they fail to note and they fail to heed. And so their life becomes nothing rather than something. But that last case, again, I want to emphasize, is instructive. Nothing is predetermined. Nothing is coercive here in this event. Nothing says you must do that and can't do that. All of them are free people. The possibility of saying no to the divine dimension of reality is real in every event. We need to realize that. It is always possible to say no. We have the example that I just thought of, so I'll just add it in, of this annunciation to Mary. Mary could have said, you've got to be kidding me. You want me to have this son who's going to grow up and get crucified? Thanks. I would rather have him be a plumber. So no, I'm not doing that. Mary could have said no. But as the story goes, Mary says yes. Anyway, that's event. Meeting a free person in a non-coercive way, saying, here is what's going on in what's going on. So as circumscribed as we all are by our mortality, our physical, mental, spiritual limitations, we are all free people, and it is very good to remember that. We can say no, just as we can say yes. We can fail to perceive just as we can perceive. I just finished reading a book by Gordon Thomas and Greg Lewis that was entitled Defying Hitler. It is in large part a story of the many people who perceived in the rise of Hitler a call to resist what Hitler was doing, to resist for the sake of the common humanity that all people share, that was even then being denied completely by the Nazis in Germany. No such book as that would be complete, of course, without at least a brief account of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor, who actually was executed within a month or so of the end of the war. Bonhoeffer had already been banned from preaching when Kristallnacht occurred on November 11, 1938. Thomas and Lewis describe how Bonhoeffer was just stunned by this. He couldn't believe this had really happened. And so he went to his Bible the next night after he heard about it. So this is now the 12th of November, trying to help himself understand what he was supposed to do. How do I respond to this? Paul's letter to the Romans reminded him of this. To the Jews belong the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. That's what Paul says about the Jews. The Jews were God's people. Jesus himself was Jewish. So Bonhoeffer knew there was something wrong. He continues to read. He continues to leaf through his Bible, and he comes to Psalm 74, which goes in part, they burn all of God's houses in the land. For Bonhoeffer, this was event. This was the moment. God was speaking to him. This is about here and now, the authors of this book write. This Lutheran pastor saw what was happening in what was happening, and he perceived in his world as it was then a summons he would not refuse. And by the way, at first he sort of did. He went to the United States for a little while, then came back. Flight, in other words, was an option for Bonhoeffer, as, for example, it was for Paul Tillich, who chose to get out of Dodge, by the way. But that wasn't Bonhoeffer's response. His call was to remain in Germany and to resist. Resist for the sake of all that is just and good and holy. Resist for the sake of his own faith. Resist, ultimately, as well, for the sake of the future of Germany. But resist he must. And so, resist he did. Sophie Scholl, much less known, I'd never heard of Sophie Scholl prior to reading Defying Hitler. She joined the White Rose, which is a group who simply produced and distributed anti-Nazi pamphlets, which by the time the White Rose got rolling was a capital crime. So this was serious stuff. And she did it not because she was by nature a revolutionary, not even because she was by nature a resistor. She was an upper middle class young woman with a good education who could have, along with the vast majority of her peers, simply shut up and gone along. That is what most people did, particularly the most bourgeois middle class Germans. But she did it, she resisted, because in the chaos swirling around her, she perceived that event which was the suffering of Jews, the event which was the suffering of German soldiers, in what she quickly perceived was a futile war, because she didn't really join the White Rose until after the invasion of Russia in June of 1941. She did it because, along with her brother, she had to say, she felt a call to say yes to this moment. And for her, yes meant going underground, writing anti-Nazi pamphlets, anti-war pamphlets. Again, though, we need to notice, this is not God acting on a mindless automaton. Nor is it people simply deciding on their own to go out and be heroes. That was not what she was trying to do, and that is not how she described herself. She described herself as a person responding to the moment. In other words, a person who saw what was going on in what was going on and said yes to the moment. So the event, again, as Marianne has described it, it was interactive with all of these people. People hearing from their environment a call. People realizing what's going on in what's going on and responding to that call according to their own lights and their best understanding of what they could do. Klaus von Stauffenberg attempts to assassinate Hitler. He actually plants the bomb that nearly kills him, not quite. Sophie simply writes and distributes pamphlets. Two rather different responses, but yet the same. And responding to the same moment, being caught up by the same event. Less dramatically, and it's one of my favorite stories, and it might not even be historical, but it is true. Henry David Thoreau, he hated slavery. He lived in a free state, but he still hated slavery. And there were federal poll taxes at that time that actually were distributed throughout the United States, and so Thoreau refused to pay the poll tax. And as a result, he writes about this, by the way, in his book on civil disobedience. Anyway, he is arrested and thrown in jail. And who should come to visit him but Ralph Waldo Emerson? And Emerson says, "David," to him in jail, "what are you doing in there?" And Thoreau's response, it might be apocryphal, but again, it's true, was, "Ralph, what are you doing out there?" For Thoreau, this was moment. For Thoreau, this was event. An event that He saw what was going on and what was going on, and Emerson clearly didn't. So you can have all your transcendental woo-woo stuff, but Ralph, this is what's going on and what's going on. What are you doing out there? And Ralph apparently had no answer. It was a short conversation. But you see, Thoreau, living in a free state, nevertheless hears the call. He hears the call from a world that he inhabited, that was all around him. And the call was, refuse to support a system that suppresses and oppresses human beings, no matter how oblique and indirect it may be. He was a free person. He could have paid the poll tax. Nearly everybody did. Ralph Waldo Emerson did. But he didn't. Because in his freedom, he was affirming this higher call. In this freedom, he was responding to event. And again, I want to say, in all of these cases, I want to say that God is in these events. Now, the universe these people inhabited, and some of these people, by the way, that I've mentioned are fictional, some are not. That's the world we all here inhabit right now. We inhabit that same world. In certain moments of our lives, the world calls to us through event, as Caputo and Marianne, interpreting Caputo, has described it. In fact, I would say this with Marianne, every moment of our lives can be event in the sense that Caputo and Marianne spoke of it. I realized, for example, as a very young kid, in fact, in kindergarten, that I was drawn to people who seemed kind of lonely and lost and unloved. I think probably that's my core wound as well, and I really think that's what it takes one to know one, maybe, or something, I don't know. But I was really drawn to these sorts of people. It started in kindergarten with a young girl that nobody liked, and I have no idea to this day why, and so I liked her. And I don't know what that was about, except maybe wound speaking to wound, I don't know. So we'll jump ahead many years. When I went to seminary, or when I was applying to go to seminary and trying to become a candidate in the Diocese of Oregon, I told the usual lies to the Commission on Ministry about being called by God to this particular job, this vocation, as it was termed then. And I lowered my voice and was very profound and important when I did that. Of course, I know God has called me to be a priest. I knew no such thing, by the way. But over time, throughout the course of my ordained ministry, I have discovered something. God did not call me to a particular job. Of that, I am sure now. God did not say to me, Bill, I want you to be a priest. God has even a lower voice than I have. I am certain of that now, that God did not call me to be a priest. I had already discovered, though, without really realizing it, that my true vocation was to respond to a certain kind of event. The event that happens when you just sit with people and help them sort themselves out, even as they help you sort yourself out. That was and is my true vocation. That is the kind of event I, in my freedom, am most sensitive to and most capable of responding to. This is not to say I do it well. This is not to say I notice more than 1% of the time that it happens. But it is to say that is, you've talked about your gift, that's my gift, that I somehow can do that, at least once in a while. That is how I interacted with the divine sense within me and within the universe. And I chose to respond to that because of my family and cultural and social context. I chose to respond to that by going to seminary and becoming a priest. I could have fulfilled that same call as a teacher, or I dare say as an attorney, or any other number of things. Had I not been able to fulfill it as a priest, I would have soon stopped being a priest. If I'd gone to law school and discovered there's something about being a lawyer that I just can't relate to, it would have been because I couldn't have done that very well. So, or a teacher. It wouldn't have been because I'm a crappy teacher, because I probably would have been, but maybe I would have been, and maybe I wouldn't have. But I wouldn't have stopped being a teacher unless I discovered I couldn't do what I was truly called to do. I couldn't, in other words, fulfill my vocation. I couldn't find the moment in that. So this is why, and here I'm going to stop, but this is why I have always resisted the notion that God has a plan for each of our lives. I have always resisted that notion, and I do not believe it for one second. God does not have a plan for your life. But I do believe that God has a purpose for every life. And that purpose is summarized best in both, actually in the entire Bible, both the old, what we call the Old Testament and the New Testament, and I believe it's summarized best in this way. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's the purpose. And that, I believe, is fundamentally and in the end what Event calls us to, is to live out that purpose. And how you do it depends upon you. There is no plan for how to do it. God did not say, I don't think, to Milry, again, I want you to be a teacher. But Milry sensed in herself that this is a way to respond to Event. She might not have had the vocabulary to do that. She might not have had the words or anything, the conceptuality, but I think that's what happened. God did not say to certain people there, I want you to be a musician. But that is how we respond. Some of us respond to Event. And I cannot believe, I cannot listen to the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony anymore with this context without saying, that was a man who was caught up by Event, who heard what was going on and what was going on, even though by then, by the time he wrote the Seventh Symphony, he was almost stone deaf. And by the time he wrote the Ninth, he was stone deaf. He finished conducting the Ninth Symphony for the first time, and the principal violinist had to turn him around so that he could see that the audience was giving him a standing ovation. He couldn't hear a word of it. He never heard the Ninth Symphony except inside his head. Never heard it once. But he was caught up by Event. He saw what was going on and what was going on, and he wrote those symphonies. That's the way he loved God and loved neighbor. That's the way he responded to his vocation. So, in the end, it seems to me this. It is well to remember also the context in which Luke places that statement that you shall love the Lord your God and you shall love your neighbor as yourself in his gospel. The context is the parable of the Good Samaritan. Neighbor turns out to be anyone. Neighbor turns out to be everyone. Neighbor even turns out to be the Good Samaritan himself, in a way that you talked about. Marianne gave the best sermon I've ever heard on this topic, and she kind of turned it on its head a little bit. But neighbor is all of us. Those who hate us, those who love us, those we hate, those we love. Those we don't know, those we know well, those we care about, those we don't. Neighbor is everybody. To fulfill that purpose to the very best of our abilities, each in our own way, is to respond to call and summons. And it is to live in hope every moment of our lives that we can do this because we are free people. We are not so circumscribed by events that we have no choice, either to say yes or no. Nor are we so benighted that we never notice and we always say no. The hope of the world is that we say yes. Our own hope is that we say yes, at least from time to time. So let me finish with a single quote, not by Robert Hunter, but by Howard Thurman, who I think summarizes what at least I'm talking about here in terms of this concluding little part about vocation. Thurman once wrote, Thurman was a great civil rights leader. In fact, he was one of the inspirations for people like Martin Luther King Jr. and so forth. Thurman said, "Do not ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do that. Because that's what the world needs. People who have come alive." That's vocation That's called someone's hope. That's seeing what's going on in what's going on. That is, I think, what this is all about. Thank you.
Let's just sit with this for a minute.
I rarely speak out loud at something like this, but visiting with a friend during the break, I realized that the first time that I came to hear Bill and Marianne do one of these was an event for me. And I would bet that there are other people in the room that feel the same way. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome.
She was our potted plant.
Yes. Our platted pot?
Patted pot, potted plant. Potted.
Okay. And thank you for reading that part about doing what comes alive or makes you come alive. Yeah. But my question is, how do you prevent yourself from second-guessing everything? Yeah. You know, well, that's just irrational, or that's not possible, or maybe you're just making this up. And I find myself doing that a lot.
Well, if you're me, Marianne may have something to say about this, yep, too. If you're me, you don't, actually. But if you're me, it's possible to say, you know, I may be crazy. I know I'm neurotic, and I may be crazy, but I need to pursue this anyway. And it's a line I got from 12-step groups. Feelings are not actually facts. And my subjective feeling about myself is not actually the objective reality about the world. Somehow you have to get there and then respond anyway. So I have no advice to give you about overcoming that sense of second guessing. I have no advice to give you about that. The only thing I can say is we can live with it. It's possible to learn to live with it, and at least periodically to not allow it to steer the bus that is you.
Does anyone else here have a response to this? Because I'm sure that a number of us, I'm not quite like Bill in this way. I second guess all the time. So is there some people who have experiences of this that can maybe shed some light for all of us? Thanks.
Okay.
Good.
I live in Prineville, and I had an event kind of happen to me where I saw a need for the young children, and that eventually got named under 10, to have books and to have access to books. And I knew about free lending libraries, and I had a feeling I needed to place them in the lower income areas, especially in the trailer courts in town, of which once I had this idea, I'd only been in Prineville a couple years, and I started seeing these trailer courts everywhere, tucked in. And I had second guesses, as I'd never done anything like that. I didn't know how to build them. I didn't know how. I really was trying to get them to the Hispanic part of the community, which is very isolated and doesn't, you don't interact very much. So I didn't know how to start. So I talked with my pastor there and told him my idea. And he was like, that's a good idea. And I said, but I don't know how to get started. And he said, well, think about it a little bit and talk to people about it and see what happens. Well, that's what happened, because people started, a friend of a friend calls me and says, I found a woman in town who's just retired from the Forest Service. She likes your idea. I'm going to introduce you to her.
Right.
I said, I need to find, you know, we had several of us getting started. There was three or four of us, but we knew we needed to interact with the Hispanic community. And then somebody said, oh, you need to talk to so-and-so at Medical Mutual, who's a translator, who was like opening this huge door because like three generations had lived in that community. She had relatives in almost every one of the trailer courts. She was very active in the Catholic Church. I mean, there was just, she had all these places. And she had young girls. And so together, we started place, we had a design, nobody had any ideas, and we ended up designing these rather large boxes. We found people to build them. We found other people to decorate them.
Yeah.
You know, and we've continued over the years to place them. We just did another one in the park. The park district connected with us and said, oh, you can put them in our playgrounds.
That's great.
So, I mean, it's amazing. And then you get the friends of the library who let you go to the sales and they give you whole boxes of the books they're giving away for a buck because they said, we know what you're going to do with them.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, you can have second doubts, but my word is talk about it and see what happens. Yeah. If it's a good idea, help will come or people will come and surround you.
Great. And I love what you're saying because what happened is this community, this communication, this interconnectivity, and that it just, who would have thunk it? You know, it's like, well, this is impossible. I've never done this before. And it is possible.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's when Jack Caputo talks about our hope is in the impossible. That doesn't sound very promising, does it? But I think what he's getting at is, I don't think this sounds possible. But things happen. And I love the fact that what your experience was, that you're not alone in this. Remember last time I played this song from Jacques Brel, No Love, You're Not Alone. You know, don't let it get you down, you know. And so I think, and two, there's a big difference between fantasy and imagination. So if, because event is not about fantasy.
Right.
It's about something real. And it may require our imagination, but I make big distinctions between fantasy and imagination. But if there's something stirring, maybe expose it a little bit,
yeah.
You know, and see if there are flickers elsewhere that will shed some light on it, okay? So, Bill, do you want to?
No, I mean, okay. I just, the only thing I say is, I'm the me that God loves.
You're what?
I'm the me that God loves, with all of my difficulties and all of my inability to deal with what's actually happening. That's the me that God loves, so... and that's all I've got to work with. That's all God has to work with. Oh, well, we'll see what happens next. So, I mean, yeah.
Thank you very much for what both of you have said, and especially Bill, I appreciated because you spoke so much more concretely about
yes.
Call. And for me, call has been a very significant part of my life. I was very privileged to have three distinct conversions that came perhaps out of events, as Mary Ann suggested. And interestingly enough, the first was to the Creator God, and the second one was to Jesus, and the third one was to the Spirit. How about that? Although I don't like the word Trinity because it's too white, male, European, whatever.
You know what Phyllis Trible said, that the Trinity is two men and a bird.
Now remember, St. Augustine, who wrote the great treatise, De Trinitate, was from North Africa. Just remember that.
In any case, after all this, you know, I came out really feeling that all Christians were called to be prophets. And now I realize that may not be the case. In any case, for myself, and one of the things I had to do in regard to the second guessing was talk to people, just as the previous person who spoke. And I really felt I needed to speak out against all the evils that I was seeing around me in the world. And yet I was very hesitant to risk incarceration because that scared me to death. I just didn't think, you know, how could I survive being incarcerated? And so I spoke to a woman on a, riding on a bus for several hours in Colombia, and because she'd been incarcerated for 6 months for the School of the Americas. And so I just went in with her to the all the details of the experience. And then I came out of that bus ride saying, you know, that's not impossible for me. I could do that. In any case, I have done that several times since and ended up, as many of you realize, with several periods of incarceration and probation and whatever for different things, like the School of the Americas, where we were teaching soldiers and other military people from Latin America to go out and kill and disappear and torture and all these things in their home countries and so forth. But there are many different things that I feel very passionate about and have been willing to step up on. And so I'm just very thankful for that call that I have, and I do believe that every one of us does have a call. I just think feel that urgently that, you know, in our world today especially, we can't help but see problems, and each of us can do something. But anyway, thank you very much. And this, the other thing I just wanted to add was the second-guessing thing, was what I like to do is use a lot of discernment questions that I've adapted from someone who wrote some much more pious ones than I did, but to help me answer, you know, whether this, what are my motives for wanting to do this, and how is it going to affect other people, and all these different questions. So that can also be a help in avoiding the second-guessing.
Say something.
So, thank you.
Yeah, just one thing. Yeah. This is in large part why I think I agree with you completely that we all have we all are capable of responding to the moment. We are all capable. We have a call, and which is why I no longer like to talk about vocation in terms of as the name of a job. It's what we are at our most alive.
And I really appreciate your own passion and commitment, and it's really on the ground what you're doing. I also want to say to some of us, I don't think we should underestimate the effect that seeing the bright field or seeing the snow geese has on our way of interacting with the world and with people. In a way that actually really matters.
Yeah.
Okay? And some of us are going to be able to do something that's, stand in front of the tank that's coming towards us, or that's going to do a sit-in for something, or, you know, it's going to take it to the streets, and I'm all for that, all right? But what I don't want the rest of us to mistake is that some of the examples that I've been sharing about that moment that was minted in the kingdom, as Billy Collins said, that made him rethink everything that had come before and that is coming ahead. Don't underestimate the transformative power of that awareness and the presence that creates. Yeah. Because I think those things also change the world, mm-hmm. Okay? So it's a both and here. It's not an either or, but just some of this stuff may seem subtle, like the stone in the middle of the road, or but that's not to say that it doesn't have a kind of numinous, almost epiphanic effect, right. Of, wow, you know, this life, this world, I'm in it. I'm not missing it. What a privilege it is to be part of this. And then let that evoke your own sensibilities. I'm all for discernment guidelines. In fact, I've used 10 of them here every time we start. But also, don't get your head too involved. That's how second-guessing runs amok at me, is that my mind will just start, well, what about this, and yada, yada, yada. And I completely disengage from what might actually be luring me or moving me or opening my heart, even, okay? So again, this is all... There's a lot of play and nuance and care in all of this, but and these are fraught times, no question. But I also say, work on being kind of supple and reflective and keep your heart soft. Okay.
It's quarter till, so we do have time for one or two more thoughts if people have them.
Great, Dave, thanks.
This is just piggybacking on what you all have well said, but Bill, you mentioned Howard Thurman. Mm. And one of the things that came up for me when Marianne was talking was how he caught a lot of flack because he didn't do what King did.
Right.
He didn't march in the streets. He didn't go to jail. He didn't do a lot of those kinds of things. But King himself and a number of other people said, if it hadn't been for Thurman, right, we would have missed the heart or the soul or the authenticity of this whole movement.
Yeah.
So I guess I just want to hold that up kind of in harmony with what you all are saying. Then also, I cannot remember the author, but a book called And the Trees Shall Clap Their Hands, where the woman who writes the book talks about how my husband and I are spies for God. And she said, here we are, we're sitting in a restaurant, and we hear just little snippets of conversation. We note the sounds of silverware clanking on a table or on a plate. It's snowing outside, and the snow is slanting up and tapping on the window. And it's our privilege, our responsibility to pay attention to all that because somebody else is missing it. And so I'm back to the poetry of that Marianne left with us today and say, yeah, that's enough. That's more than enough. I may not have to go to jail. I may not have to die a martyr. Maybe I'm a spy for God today.
Yeah. Thanks. That reminds me of, speaking of violating one of the listening hearts things, reminds me of...
Were you thinking while he was talking?
Yes, I was, because I was. Uh-oh. Guilty as charged. John Cage, who is a composer that makes no sense to me, I will say. But one of his most famous works, that 1 minute 49 or whatever it was, where he just simply sits at the piano and does nothing. And the first time he played it, he got a standing ovation. And I can even play that piece.
We might want to try that next time.
His point was that the entire group is the moment, the event, the instrument, and that it's precisely the ruffling of the programs, the shuffling of the feet, the shifting in your seat, the looking and sort of quizzically at your neighbor and saying, what's going on here? That's what we need to pay attention to, and we need to take that into the world. And so thank you for that, because it makes more sense out of John Cage to me, who doesn't make any sense to me, by the way.
That's great.
Would you take a couple of minutes and talk about Jesus in the context of vocation? How maybe what that was like for him in your imagination?
That is an important enough question that I hate to do it off the cuff, but of course I'll at least start. To begin to answer that question, I would want to think in terms of Jesus himself as event. I think that's where I would start, because there's something in that guy. And by the way, as you perhaps know, I'm so skeptical about the historicity of the Gospels that I don't think there's hardly anything we know about Jesus. I think we know what the Nicene Creed says. Born, you know, as a human being, born Jewish, crucified. I think that's what we know about the historical Jesus. So, and that's pretty much it. But there's something about him that evoked so completely a sense of presence, a sense of call, a sense of summons, that although most people said no thank you, a few said yes. And of course, the Gospels and the church tradition is so patriarchal that we don't notice that a majority of his followers were women. In fact, a large majority of his followers were women. They saw what was going on and what was going on with Jesus. So in terms of vocation, I would say Jesus is the one who evoked in some people that highest and best sense of themselves, where they stopped wondering what does the world need and started wondering what brought them alive. And it was something in him that brought them alive. And this to me, and the interesting thing about this to me was not that it was seemed to be not a loyalty to Jesus personally, but a loyalty to whatever Jesus really was and represented. And so he was not a cult leader who said, I need to have you be loyal to me no matter what I do. He rather said, he was more transparent than that, and said, where your loyalty needs to reside is in what I'm channeling, to use the kind of New Age word, or what is actually going on in what is going on. That's where I would start to answer that question about Jesus and vocation. So our vocation in that sense, therefore, if it is to be consistent with what I think was going on with him then, is to see through him to what he saw. That's the way of finding out what's going on and what's going on with him, and a fulfilling vocation. So it'd be something like that.
And I would say that Jesus' vocation was probably rooted in the very things we've been talking about. And that sense of the nearness of the sacred, the holy, that what Heschel calls radical amazement at it all, you know. And within the context of his, here's the history piece, but within the context of his first century world and what some of the struggles were around injustice and oppression, and that people weren't being treated equally, that there was this, you know, oppressive system of the few at the top and everybody else was not, you know, worthy of all of that. And he just knew that that was wrong. And so my sense is that he was moved by the very things that move us to be more compassionate and humane, okay? And he responded really powerfully even amidst the political, economic, and social, and religious strains of his day. So he was also very, very courageous. I would say that what Jesus has had in him, we have in us. So it's not believing in Jesus to help us believe in ourselves, although I think that's the way we go. But I think Jesus embodies what we have. I think he incarnates what we incarnate, which is an awareness of the holiness of, and the sacredness of life. And what you said earlier about love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. And the big kicker in Christianity is and love your enemy. Okay. Which is a variation on love your neighbor. Okay. So my hunch is that his vocation, the way he grappled with things, I think it had everything to do with his experience of quote-unquote God, the way he perceived human beings, the way he interacted with nature, not unlike native traditions, that he knew there was something really interconnected with it all. And, you know, from what I sense about him, he was a man of tremendous courage, and I love what you've said about the freedom to act. In a context where it seemed like there was no freedom to act. He was a peasant, probably illiterate. It doesn't mean he didn't know his Torah, but he was, you know, he was not one of the empowered ones in the way that we would think of it. So I don't want to over-idealize Jesus in terms of his own vocation and what he accomplished. I think that Jesus was one of us and calls the question on our own humanity.
One more thought, if there is, and then we need to wrap it up. Okay. We can wrap it up.
Our next session will be March 14th, the second Saturday, okay? March 14th. And Bill, you and I are going to talk about...
Well, I didn't realize this is a tag team thing. Yeah, we're going to talk essentially about Holy Week, about the execution of Jesus, the events, the triumphal entry leading up to that. So we will be focusing on a rather narrow window of time there.
Right, and we will be in the season of Lent, which in the liturgical year is the season when we journey with Jesus from Galilee to Jerusalem. In the Christian narrative, that's what Lent is about, the journey with Jesus from Galilee to his final entry into Jerusalem and to his execution. So that's the season of Lent. So we thought that this would be an opportunity to sort of unpack that. And for those of you who've been with us before, we can't help but readdress the issue of what we have called, Jack Caputo has called, strong and weak theology.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll play with that a bit too as we look at the stories about Jesus entering into Jerusalem. And then our final session will be on, is it the 11th of April, which happens to be Holy Saturday in our liturgical year. It's the day before Easter. Yeah. Okay, so I think that's also a very propitious time to have this session of this year close. I am going to read our poem for this year from The Place Where We Are Right by Yehuda Amichai. And I would suggest that as we listen to this poem today, that it's our doubts and loves that open us to possibilities and to event. From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. But doubts and loves dig up the world like a mole, a plow, and a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. See you next time. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you
for being with us. Thank you.